Welcome to This Wild Life, a conservation podcast that brings you up to date with frontline conservation efforts from around the world. Expect stories of wild adventures and get to know the characters who are dedicating their lives to protect our beautiful planet. We're here to bring the wild to you. Hello and welcome to This Wild Life podcast. I'm Amy Turner and I'll be your host for today. Now, we've had a little bit of a break last week after our 10th episode, and now we're back and raring to go. And I think we're all in for a bit of a treat with today's guest. Today, I'm thrilled to be talking to Dr. Johan Moraes, a world-renowned wildlife vet and founder of Saving the Survivors. Saving the Survivors is an organisation and a team of wildlife vets that will treat any animal in need, from lion to wild dog. However, a lot of Dr. Johan's work is focused on rhino, purely as a result of the growing demand for rhino horn in Southeast Asia. As most of you will know, it is this demand for rhino horn that is driving poachers to go out and brutally kill rhino in devastating numbers. Now, although the topic of rhino poaching mainly brings about sadness, anger, and, in my opinion, highlights some of the worst of humanity, but with the privilege of talking to Dr. Johan about his work, I think this episode really highlights the best of humankind. On that note, today we'll be hearing Dr. Johan's experiences from the front line of rhino conservation, including talking about a special rhino that he treated named Tandy. He'll also talk about the innovative techniques that the team of wildlife vets at Saving the Survivors have developed in order to save rhino, including facial reconstructions. Saving the Survivors really creates hope from hurt. And with all of that said, let's get started. So, hi Johan, it's absolute pleasure to have you join us today.
Hello Amy, you know, thank you very much for having me on, and also hello to everyone that listens in. It's a real privilege to talk to you guys.
No, it's completely our pleasure. And so perhaps we could start off with the early days of your career. I understand you started off as an equine veterinary surgeon and then swapped over to wildlife. So perhaps it would be great to hear about how you came to become a wildlife vet.
All right. So I partly grew up in Etosha National Park, where my father was a game ranger. And I think I probably developed my love for wildlife during those earlier years already. I can clearly remember helping him, you know, looking after captured black rhino and a boma. And I still have a video, one of those old videos where I was riding on a white rhino. I don't even know you know, where it came from or why it was that tame or something, but I still have that video. So I think my love was born there, and then I eventually decided to go into veterinary science, which I did in 1986, ended in 1991, and then spent some time in private practice. I was really, really interested in going into wildlife at that stage, around about 1992. The problem, Amy, at that stage in South Africa was that there was not a lot of wildlife jobs available. You know, because the wildlife industry was not really booming at that stage or developed. So you know, the only jobs at that stage was really in national parks, and all those jobs were really taken. So eventually I decided to go into general practice. I then decided to go into horses. So I did horses and small animals for about 5 years. And teaching is actually in our family, and I love teaching. So then I decided to join the our faculty of veterinary science in that was end of 1998, and I stayed there for 18 years because I really enjoyed that. Teaching students and working in the hospital, doing difficult cases and so on. But at that stage, the entire wildlife industry started booming really, and it developed more and more and more up till probably 2008, 9, when it really was doing well with regards to species like buffalo, roan, sable, and even wildebeest. And then shortly after that, something started which was a little bit unnatural, which we called exotic species. Now, it's not exotic species meaning they're exotic from South Africa, but it was color variants. So where you normally would get, let's say, a normal color, dark colored blue wildebeest, people started to breed these color variants where you, for instance, sorry, get a golden wildebeest, or which was like a yellowish color, which is completely an abnormal color. I mean, they do occur in the wild, but at very, very low percentages. But people started breeding them specifically for those colors, and people started to pay quite a lot of money for them. To give you an example, a golden wildebeest would probably sold for, well, not probably, they did sell for 1.5 million rand, whereas a normal wildebeest would probably sell for 20,000 rand. Okay, so it's a huge amount of money. And that really took off with wildebeest, with and several other species. And at the same time, buffalo also increased in value dramatically. So what then really happened is because these animals were worth such a lot of money, whenever anything went wrong with them, they got caught in snares, they fractured a limb, they got wounds and so on. People said, please fix this because this animal is worth quite a lot of money, and I want you to fix it. So probably around about, I would say, 2010, no, even earlier, 2008, 9-ish, we started doing quite a lot of wildlife work at the university. And these animals basically came to us because we were large animal veterinarians, large animal surgeons, people that listen to this conversation of us would recognize that, for instance, operating a horse and recovering a horse after a fracture or a colic operation is so much different than, for instance, operating a small animal. Okay. Let's say you have a small animal with a fracture, it's got a radius fracture, you would fix the fracture and you would put it in a small cage and it would just lie there. It will wake up. It doesn't have to stand up on its own. You can come in and help it up and help it to stand and so on. And with some TLC, you can look after it. If I, for instance, operate a horse with a fracture and I put plates and screws on there, we put it in a recovery box, and that horse has to get up on its own. You can't really help it up. We have ropes and stuff into the recovery room, but it's quite dangerous to go into this room and try and help this horse up. And often, when they get up and it's a quite a bad recovery, they can often fracture their leg again, or they can break those plates. So doing surgery in large animals has got its own sense of complications, and because of that, all these large animals, being either rhino or wildebeest or buffalo, actually came to us, and therefore we started doing more and more wildlife. Up to a point where the poaching started in South Africa with rhino quite badly, which was about in 2008. And they started hacking, you know, these horns off with rhino. You know, some which are still alive. And around about 2010, when it really picked up, at that stage, we were also called out for, you know, with rhino, with these massive injuries. But that's basically how I almost migrated from being an equine surgeon to a large animal or a wildlife surgeon.
It's quite a journey, and it's also so interesting to hear about the kind of equine side. Myself and Johan were having a chat just before we went on air about Johan's equine work, and I have a background in equestrian sport and ridden all of my life, and I often think that horses, especially the fresh ones, act like rhino.
Interestingly enough, and you know, we will talk about this a little bit later again, you know, remind me, but we think that, or we always thought that a rhino is very close to a horse. So, you know, whether you, when you get to a rhino, you must treat it basically like a large horse. But we've now found out that that is not true. But we can talk about it a little bit later.
Absolutely. And so moving on to Saving the Survivors, and obviously you're a founding member. And if anyone hasn't come across the work of Saving the Survivors, please do go and check out their website. It's really, really good. So could you perhaps give us an overview of this incredible, groundbreaking work that you do and your mission?
Yeah, sure. So it was really born out of the need initially to look after these rhino that were so badly poached, right? So as I said, the poaching really started in 2008, and it picked up to about 2012. I think in 2012 we lost about 670 rhino only in South Africa, and we just realized that at that time, because of all these rhino being shot and several of them being the horns hacked off, and they were left with these big open wounds on their faces, that, you know, first of all, we don't have the knowledge or the know-how to treat these cases. And second of all is nobody is actually doing it. If you as a private veterinarian has to attend to this rhino for, you know, often for months, you know, in a row, or, you know, sometimes hope and say, you know, over years, it is not financially, you know, sustainable for the owner to pay you. He would rather put that animal down. So I said, let's start Saving the Survivors, where we really focus on treating these animals and get to know how we can help these animals, because we don't know what's happening in 10, 15, 20 years' time. Hopefully this you know, poaching problem will go away, and all the knowledge that we've built up, we can just bank somewhere and say, right, guys, if you ever need it, it's there. However, if this goes south and we lose more and more and more rhino, like, for instance, that has happened in Asia, where you only get less than 100 Jarman rhino or less than 100, you know, a Sumatran rhino, you cannot, if one of their animals gets poached and are left with a huge open wound, we can't say, oh, we don't have the know-how, you know, to treat these animals, rather put it down. Because if you lose 2 out of 60 animals, it's quite a high percentage. And if you keep on doing that, eventually you end up with only 30 or 40 animals, which we don't want to do, because your genetic variability, you know, gets down to only a few animals. And you know, for us to treat these animals, you don't learn to do all these treatments over 2 or 3 months. It took us years to do that, okay, over 3, 4, 5, 6 years. So mm-hmm. if you do that, for instance, with a species like, you know, the Javan rhino, which we think there's only about 60 to 80 left, if we only start now and we say, right, we'll be able to treat these rhinos successfully in 6 years' time, we might be left only with 10 rhino. So we then started this NGO that focused mainly on rhino initially, but now we do all endangered species because, as you would know as well, and a lot of our listeners, you know, elephant is under threat, wild dog is under threat, you know, cheetah, lion, there's so many species, pangolin, that are under threat. So we've really expanded our vision and our mission to treat all endangered species.
Mm, and for those at home, there's fantastic footage out there of Dr. Johan and the team working with a range of species. And one thing that I'm particularly interested in is the innovation and development of veterinary techniques that I suppose are specific to rhino and the unique challenges of treating these horrific facial wounds. So could we perhaps talk a little bit about this and how you bring these animals back from the brink?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we could talk a little bit about that. So, you know, initially or in the beginning, I think I need to say that it's always, you know, it's always a team effort. It's, you know, my picture might be up there all the time, but I think people have to realize that it is often a team effort. You know, you talk to other people, you ask even human doctors. I've asked countless human doctors' advice. You know, some of my colleagues have helped me. And eventually you get to a point where you say, okay, this might work. So when I was called out, I think the first really bad survivor I was called out to was a rhino called Hope in the Eastern Cape. But before we went to her, there was a rhino also in the Eastern Cape that was poached. Luckily, her wound was not that severe. That was called Tandi. So we flew down to the Eastern Cape a couple of times to treat a Tandi. And we really, you know, the crux is we really didn't know what to do. We've never had to deal with these injuries ever before. Nobody knew how to deal with them. There were no textbooks that you could actually go to and go, okay, page number 46, paragraph 4, you know, shows you exactly how to deal with this injury. So
yeah,
we just
absolutely
applied basic, you know, surgical principles and basic wound principles, which we quickly realized because this is a 2-ton animal and it walks freely in the wild, didn't work that well. Okay. Mm. The other thing which was also quite telling is initially we realized after about 3-4 months that if you have a gunshot wound, for instance, on a rhino's bum or on its leg, and it doesn't involve critical structures, it will heal fairly quickly, probably within 8 to 10 days or even 2 weeks. However, these wounds on their faces do not heal for some other reason. And, you know, going back to my horse background, we know that horses' legs heal badly below the carpus and below the hock. And I think it's for some other reason, you know, the research hasn't been done, but I think it's the same with the facial area of a rhino. For some other reason, there's enzymes or a shortage of enzymes there that the facial area of a rhino doesn't heal well. And you have to, as a veterinarian, you have to go in there and do certain things to assist it, you know, to make it heal better. All right. So I think the worst injury then initially was Hope, where when they sent me that picture, I actually had a look at it and I thought, there is just no way that we can actually deal with this. It's a massive injury. It's completely into the sinuses. They take a chainsaw and they've started basically just above above her nostrils, and they would cut all the way, just missing her eyes, to take as much horn as possible. So there was this huge gaping wound going directly into her paranasal sinuses, raw, bloody. It was just a mess. And I had a look at that and I thought, I don't think we can heal that. I think we should put it out. The vet down there, Dr. Will Fall, said, well, yes, we can put it down, but, you know, we'll learn nothing, you know. So why don't we give her a chance? Why don't you come down? You know, let's try and treat her. We might learn a lot. Plus, we're going to put her down anyhow. So why not actually give her a chance? You know, why not try some stuff on her? Because she's still a young animal. And, you know, I think that's the crux. When you do succeed and heal these animals, especially females, they can go on, like Tandi. After we've treated Tandi, she's already had 3 calves. So did you actually save one animal, or did you save 4 already? Well, you actually saved 4, okay, by only saving 1. So I said, right, let's do that. So I then started the long road with Hope. And I think Hope really taught us a massive amount of info on how and how not to treat these massive injuries on the face. One huge problem with that was, you know, we could get the infection under control. That worked really well. We could get the pain under control. That worked really well. But what even today is still a massive problem is because these poachers take away the underlying bone as well. They actually remove that bone either with a chainsaw or, you know, with a device they use as well. So you have nothing to cover that wound with to keep your wound dressings in place. So even today, it's still quite a massive problem to put a bandage, in inverted commas, over that wound and to keep it there. Because we know that any wound that you cover, okay, will heal 30% quicker than any other wound. So it makes sense to cover these wounds. In the less severe ones like Tandi, we've actually over 3-4 years worked it out perfectly how to cover those wounds because that underlying bone is still there. So we drill into the underlying bone with orthopedic screws and we fasten our wound treatments that way to the bone, and there is just no way that that can come off. So we leave it on for 2 months, we immobilize the rhino again, and then we take it off, and it's healed beautifully. We cannot do that with these huge, massive injuries because there's no bone underneath. So what we started to do, and it was also a colleague's of mine, a suggestion, was to cover it with a skin, but like leather. Like, you know, you use elephant leather or you use buffalo leather. So this is not a skin transplant, but the leather is conformable. It's lightweight, and it acts as a bandage to cover the wound under which you put your wound dressings. Right. So we would use orthopedic wire to fasten that to the skin all around. And that works pretty well, but unfortunately, again, you have a rhino that is, you know, that weighs 1.5 tons.
Yes.
It walks freely in the bush. And you cannot believe, Amy, they take it off. Whether you put one suture in, whether you put, I've put in 25, 30 sutures in, stainless steel, not even normal suture material, right? Normal orthopedic wire. They take it off within 2 weeks. How they manage to do it, nobody knows, but they do it. So if I can develop a system, and we're kind of busy with it now, there's a guy in the UK actually from a jewelry company called Salvari, which we work with, as to work on a specific instrument where you can gain access deep enough through the skin to put your sutures through. Because one of the challenges is if you look at the skin thickness around the face of a rhino, it is exceedingly thick. And I will say that again, it is exceedingly thick. We're talking about 3 centimeters, all right. And the reason why that is if you think about it, when they fight head to head, you know, with their horns, it is a protection mechanism for the horn not to penetrate the skin easily and for one another to hurt each other. But it makes our lives as veterinarians very, very difficult because we struggling immensely to put sutures in there. All right. So therefore we I think we on version 4 now is to work to get a device which I can put manage to put through that skin, which I can then or deeply through that skin to put a really thick wire into the skin and put that then through my elephant skin or my buffalo skin and tie that down onto the face for hopefully it will stay there for hopefully I'll be glad if it stays there 3 to 4 weeks. And humans and horses and small animals, we all know that if there's a wound that you bandage it, let's say every 3, 4, 5 days. That again is not possible in a wild animal. We cannot immobilize or dart a rhino, every 4 or 5 days. It's always a risk, because they can die under anesthesia. And it also gets very expensive because you have to hire a helicopter and it's our team that's got to be there. So we compromise. So we say, right, if we can stretch it to 3, 4 weeks, we're quite happy. And we've had a very good success with that. But you have to compromise, and unfortunately, just because of the practicality of treating these animals on the ground.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can completely imagine the complexity of the situation.
I think one other thing which we've developed, which will be quite interesting for our listeners, is to cast a rhino. Obviously, me working at the university, you cast quite a lot of horses with fractures or with problems. And then when we got, started getting these survivors with gunshot wounds to the lower limb, they're very sore. They would not take weight on it. And you take radiographs and you see there's 2 or 3 fractures there. You wonder, what should we do? Should we cast it? And initially we casted them, and I used way too little casting material. I would break it as they actually get up from anesthesia. They would break it. And I think it was probably only the fourth or fifth time of trying. I said, right, guys, let's put on a proper cast now. And we put on a proper cast, a heavy cast, but we use fiberglass, so luckily it's not that heavy. But I mean, it's a 1.5 ton animal, so you can make it, pretty heavy. And from there on, we learned how to successfully cast rhino, and we've just finished casting a black rhino in Kruger National Park that was shot in the foot, that developed massive fractures there, and we cast that over the last 2 years. Every month, every single month, and she's healed immensely well, unbelievably well. So I think we've got that down to a T, how to cast a rhino now.
That's fascinating. And can they get around with this cast on? I mean, how much does
Oh,
it affect them?
absolutely, absolutely. So most of the casts are on the lower limb, so they can walk normally. They can even run normally.
Oh, wow.
you don't want them to run because, you know, the more they move, the more your cast is, you know, being you know, put through its paces through the bush and through the water and so on. So we would normally like to just confine them a little bit so that they don't go through the entire bush with a cast. Yes. But we casted, for instance, an adult cow in one of our national reserves, which had a fracture quite high up.
Mm.
And we did a full limb cast on her. So from the foot right to the body. And she walked 3 kilometers that night, you know, with that cast.
3 kilometers.
So, yeah, you know, they do quite well with these fiberglass casts.
Mm, okay, it's fascinating. And I understand you're based in Pretoria, South Africa, at the moment. But where does Saving the Survivors operate? I gather it's a huge operation.
Yeah, so I'm based in Pretoria. Currently, I'm the only vet in South Africa for Saving Survivors. But we have two vets in Mozambique, which is a massive country. And they're the only two wildlife vets in Mozambique. So they are very busy. However, you know, we work and I've done work in Namibia, I've done work in Botswana and Zimbabwe, we've done some work in Kenya, and about 3 years ago we flew to Borneo where we worked on a Sumatran rhino. So we will work anywhere, you know, where the need is, but currently our focus is basically, you know, southern and East Africa.
Mm. Okay, and in terms of the rhinos that you go and see, how many rhinos and call-outs are you getting and treating per month, say?
You know, initially it was quite a lot because obviously there was quite a lot of rhino around. So if you talk about 2012 and so on, we would easily get between 50 and 70 calls out per year for, you know, for rhino. Now, unfortunately, because of the heavy poaching over the last 10 years, the rhino numbers have gone down dramatically. To give you an example, in one of our reserves, we used to have about 8,000 rhino there.
Mm.
There's only about 3,500 left.
Oh, gosh.
So also, if you look at the amount of orphans, you know, from these poached females that we got, we used to get easily, you know, 5 to 10 a year. Now they struggle, they might get 1 or 2 a year.
Mm.
So unfortunately, the rhino numbers have dropped substantially, which is sad. So our call-outs with, in particular to rhino, has also dropped. And, you know, I think that makes it so much more important than because the numbers have dropped, if you do get an injured rhino, is to try and treat it successfully. Because of the amount, you know, the numbers that have gone down.
Mm.
I think every life now, you know, matters and is really important to try and save, especially if it's a female. You know, not that our males are, you know, not important, but I mean, you can have a herd of, you know, 5 females with 1 male. So if we have to make a really difficult decision and it's a male and it's a really bad injury, we would go, yeah, you know, maybe let him go. But if it's a female, we'll go, no, we will treat her and we will, you know, try our best because she's a female, you know, she can have another 4, 5, 6, 7 calves after this.
Mm. And that's obviously a really interesting point and quite disturbing fact that you've highlighted there, that there are less call-outs for rhino and less orphans, but only because there are simply less rhino, I suppose.
Absolutely. We initially, let's say pre-2008, I think our numbers in South Africa were probably close to 22,000 white rhino. We're down to, you know, we don't have specific official figures, but we're thinking between 12 and 15,000 only.
Mm.
I think if we're lucky. A black rhino is even worse. We're talking about a worldwide population of only between 4,500 and 5,000, which is not a lot of animals. If you put it into perspective, Amy, that in 1970, which is not that long ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
There used to be at least 60,000 black rhino in Africa.
That's crazy 60,000. To think. Yeah.
Now we don't even have 5,000.
Yeah.
So, you know, unfortunately, if these poaching syndicates, you know, put their mind to it, these numbers can decrease very quickly. And, you know, before we know it, there's only like 200 or 300 left. So I think you must keep your finger on the pulse there.
Mm. And what's so frustrating, but I suppose a glimmer of hope, is that given half the chance, the rhino numbers will recover.
Oh,
for our listeners, that's been shown in an area in the Waterberg, South Africa. But that glimmer of hope, I suppose, is taken away if the tipping point is reached and you get this kind of genetic bottleneck and a severe reduction in genetic diversity. It just can't get to that point.
Yeah. You know, before we went on air, I think we spoke about conservation as a whole and, you know, what I would like to see probably, you know, where conservation would go. And, you know, I think it's, you know, without, you know, you said it is very complex, and it is very complex because there's, you know, there's so many factors working in on, you know, conservation issues and communities and so on. But I think you can be, you know, fairly pragmatic and say, the only thing we really need to do is look after large landscapes, you know, just protect large landscapes. And what is in those landscapes will actually look after themselves, you know, like Nyasa, you know, like Tsavo National Park in Kenya, like Kruger National Park here. Wherever you have these large landscapes, you know, just protect these huge landscapes, and all the animals in there will do well, you know, and they will breed and they will increase a number. You know, you don't have to micromanage at all. You know, like in the Waterberg, you know, just look after these landscapes. You know, there's no sense in protecting, you know, 10 hectares somewhere with, you know, three rhinos on. You know, there's no biodiversity in 3 hectares, for instance. But if we talk about 100,000 hectares or 200,000 hectares or 1 million hectares, for instance, like Kruger, you know, that makes sense. You know, the elephant, the pangolin, the wild dog, the cheetah, the lion, you know, they would do well. Yes, you must still probably keep your finger on the pulse there for, you know, diseases like rabies and TB and stuff like that. But you know, the point I'm trying to make is don't, you know, don't protect 3 hectares when you can protect 3 million hectares. It makes more sense to protect these, you know, 3 million hectares with the massive biodiversity inside there, and that will look after themselves.
Completely. And Simon Jones, one of our previous guests, alongside Kim Willeter as well, we're both talking about this very issue with regards to saving these large wilderness areas. And I think in terms of humanity as a whole, if we lose these areas, we lose a huge part of ourselves. And moving on to my next question, and it's perhaps quite difficult considering the brutality that you've witnessed, especially in terms of the aftermath of rhino poaching. But have you got hope for the future?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think I am hopeful. You obviously have your bad days as well, you know, like you would in a job, you have a bad days and mostly good days.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we as veterinarians that work with wildlife, and I think you know, all people in conservation also have your bad days. But I think you cannot really lose hope, because if you lose hope, then you can just throw in the towel and you can go, right, you know, no more anti-poaching, you know, no more this, no more that, you know, let them just, you know, take everything.
Yeah.
And we cannot allow that to happen, because the moment that happens, they will just flood it, all right? people will just come in and they will just analyze the, you know, the wildlife in Africa and across the world. We work with a investigative journalist that often goes to the Southeast Asia, and it works undercover there and takes, you know, footage of the wildlife trade there.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's when I have my bad days, when he comes back and he shows me the footage. Of what is still happening in 2020. I mean, we in 2020 we put a vehicle on Mars, right? We've almost spent $1 billion to put a vehicle on Mars. But then, you know, you see this footage of people paying $140,000 for products, you know, from Africa, being at pangolin scales, being at rhino horn, being at ivory.
Yeah.
And that sometimes makes you depressed. And and there's been several companies and moves and NGOs that has tried to stem the tide, you know, for this wildlife trade in Southeast Asia. And sometimes I think we haven't really been successful, because why is this still going on at this level? And it's not like it's there's only been two horns being sold. You know, the wildlife industry is actually booming in Southeast Asia. If we look at the current gold price, for instance, Amy, it's I think now it's around about $52 per gram, right? More or less.
Yeah.
Give or take. Rhino horn would sell for double that. At least double that.
Yeah.
And sometimes for three times that price.
It's mad.
So, you know, a piece of keratin that grows on the face of a two-ton animal is worth three times the amount of gold, for instance. So, you know, that sometimes gets to me, and that we try and we educate. And, you know, there's even companies like WildAid that does real good work in Southeast Asia. But it's almost like we don't see that in Africa. We don't see that impact here because, I mean, we've lost over 8,000 a rhino here over the last, you know, 10, 12 years. We're still losing elephants. We're still losing pangolin. Yeah, if we only lose, you know, and I don't want to sound funny, but if we don't, if we only lose 10 rhino here, you know, that's a, it's never acceptable, but, you know, we can live with it. But we don't want to lose 700 rhino here or 300 rhino here, which we are still doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, that sometimes makes you depressed, but, you know, to come back to your question, we, as a collective, I don't think we can give up. You know, we must try and, you know, fight this and, you know, keep on fighting and putting measures in place and keep on educating, you know, whether it is here, you know, African communities here, you know, whether it is in you know, Southeast Asia, we must keep on, you know, with a fight. Try and stem the tide.
Well, I must say, you know, what gives me hope is people like yourself and organizations such as Saving the Survivors who are continuing to fight day after day, and success stories like Tandy, who you mentioned earlier, for example, has gone on, as you say, to have all of these calves. It's completely miraculous, but only through your work. And so for you to continue doing this work, what do you need, and how can the general public help?
We often get the question, Amy, and yes, you know, I think being an NGO, you always need funding. And there they can just go to our website, you know, savingsurvivors.com. And there's, you know, several ways that they can, you know, donate or, you know, give support. It's really difficult for us to have support almost in any other way. You know, we go out you know, different times of the year. I'm sometimes away from home for, you know, 1 to 2 weeks. We are looking at volunteer programs, you know, currently.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's one thing that we will probably start up in the next 6 months or so. You know, the other thing is, for instance, and you know, that's where I sometimes go to, you know, especially to international veterinarians or to medical doctors. For instance, this instrument that I'm now trying to develop or to design is how to penetrate, for instance, the elephant skin. You know, that's also a kind of support.
Okay.
To give you another example is, and we've been struggling with that now for a while, is to try and tag rhino, all right?
Okay.
Traditionally, the way to tag rhino was with a with an ankle collar, which goes mm-hmm. down their lower limb. But that has, you know, several problems of its own. Sticks or rocks goes in there and they develop wounds and so on. So we want to move away there, where the more traditional way of tracking an animal is either with a collar around the neck like an elephant, or, you know, with a cheetah or a wild dog. Unfortunately, yeah. You cannot, because of the kind of anatomy, you cannot put a collar around a rhino's neck. So a rhino is really problematic. Okay. So then we said, right, guys, so we have issues with the ankle collar. We cannot put something around the neck. So where do we go from there? Then we looked at maybe implanting something underneath the skin. Then we realized, gee whiz, the skin thickness is too thick. The signal will not go through there. So we go, okay, plan D. Where do we go there? So then we said, right, let's try for a device onto the ear.
Okay.
It has to work on a little solar panel, and currently the technology is not there to have something the size and the weight of a matchbox. I think that might work on the ear, but
okay.
But the current device we have is just too heavy for our ear, so it worries them and they tear it out.
Okay.
So the next thing we try and work out is, okay, maybe we can put it on the horn. But you know, we are on the south point of South Africa, of Africa, yeah. So we're looking at technology or trying to get access to technology where we could really get a very small device which has a battery in it, which can either, you know, the battery will last a year or 2 years, or you put a little solar panel on there. But it's got to be small. It's got to be not bigger, you know, than the size of a matchbox, and almost that lightness as well, which we, in a way, then can fasten maybe to the horn, and in that way track a rhino.
Okay.
Which is then very beneficial, for instance, for the reserve or the private rhino owner, because in the morning when they get up, you know, they can monitor their rhino and go, okay, there's five rhino in the southeastern corner of my farm. Let's send the anti-poaching team there so that they don't have to cover the entire property where the rhino is not, for instance. All right?
Okay.
And it will help us, for instance, so when we treat a rhino with a heavy injury in the bush, you can just tag it and you can let it go. And in a week's time, you can look on your cell phone, you know, with an app, and you go, it's right there. We can fly to it directly. We don't have to spend 5 hours in the air with a helicopter searching for this rhino, and hopefully we will get it. So, you know, that kind of support, which is not really funding support, you know, will also be of tremendous value. But in the end of the day, you know, we have to go out, we have to travel, we have to buy wound, you know, dressings. We have to remove snares and all that stuff. So, you know, funding actually goes a long way with that as well.
Definitely. Well, I really look forward to seeing the developments in terms of that technology that you've just mentioned. Well, lastly, you know, what a marvellous look into the world of saving the survivors. Johan, thank you so much for giving us an idea about the innovation, the techniques, and also there's some really powerful messages in what you've said. And I'm sure you've inspired people to support, learn more about these urgent topics, and perhaps even encouraged a few up and coming wildlife vets. So thank you so much.
No, absolutely. No, you know, thank you very much, Amy. Again, you know, it's a team effort. I think, you know, I have many people to be grateful to, you know, that works, you know, next to me, you know, alongside me, you know, people that you ask for advice often, you know, our directors, you know, that gives us quite a lot of support and so on. So I think I'm in a very good position and privileged position that I do something that I love. So, you know, it doesn't really feel like work. Yeah. You know, sometimes, as we discussed, it's not so nice, you know, to actually get to a rhino with half a face. And,
of course.
And we spoke about this before. It's quite an emotional, you know, experience badly for you. And it's, you know, that it doesn't only come from me. You know, you can speak to many veterinarians, which has been affected very negatively because of that. But I think that's a discussion for another day. But, you know, thank you for having me. It was really a pleasure. If anyone, you know, wants to contact me and wants to spend some time with us, you know, please feel free. We would welcome them.
Well, it's completely our pleasure. And I think I speak on behalf of everyone at home. I wish you all the best, and all of the wildlife vets and the team at Saving the Survivors, good luck for the future. Hi guys, since recording with Dr. Johan, Saving the Survivors has put out an urgent appeal to raise $4,000 to get the Saving the Survivors team airborne in central Mozambique. There are 3 lions, 1 male and 2 females, that have been snared in gin traps, and they're currently dragging these traps on their front legs. Ground teams are tracking the females and satellite data is tracking the male. But without veterinary assistance, the future for these lions is incredibly bleak. I know all of you listening are fantastic at playing your part to help save our endangered wildlife. So please, even if it's just the price of a coffee, head over to Saving the Survivors' social media or website and support them to save these endangered big cats. You've listened to This Wildlife Podcast. Please do check us out on Instagram and Facebook by searching for This Wildlife Podcast. You'll find loads of photos and links to our incredible guests. And watch out for some awesome competitions coming up soon. Now, of course, our main priority is to share the conservation stories that must be told. And we need your help to grow the wildlife family and spread the word. So please do subscribe to the podcast. And if you're listening on Apple, we'd love it if you could leave us a review. Or if you're listening on another platform such as Spotify, how about you share us with a friend? So, from everyone at This Wildlife Podcast, thank you so much for your support. And remember, we're here to bring the wild to you.